This podcast is brought to you by Lannan Foundation and is available at podcast.lannan.org.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Hi, welcome. I'm Bob Martin. I'm the general manager of the Lensic. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. I appreciate that. The first thing I have to say is on behalf of the board and the staff, I cannot tell you what the Lannan Foundation means to Santa Fe and the Lensic. We're almost at the end of another series, and I think that we have probably the most extraordinary literary series in the country that the Lannan provides Santa Fe, and I just want to personally thank them for making the Lensic their home, Santa Fe their home, and doing the incredible things they do as a foundation. So thank you, and it's my great pleasure now to introduce Michael Silverblatt to you. Thank you so much for being here.
Hello again. It's a great pleasure and honor to be here. This is one of those cases where both the Lannan Foundation and Gore Vidal asked me to join, and it's an honor, a privilege, a pleasure, and, you know, I'm very frightened. Let me tell you why. I was a trembling boy when I got my copy of Myra Breckinridge. I got it as a reward for going to the dentist. Let me say honestly, it was a reward I got myself. My parents had nothing to do with it. But that book taught me as much as I was to know about sexuality and Americans, probably more than I've subsequently experienced. But to my great pleasure, you get hungry very quickly, and I read the books that Gore Vidal had written previously, among them Washington, D.C., and Julian, The City and the Pillar, and read everything subsequently. And Gore was, for me, the person who, among other things, taught me not to trust the New York Times. Taught me to be suspicious of literary theory. Well, thank you. Taught me what a writer was. Taught me what a critic was. Taught me what an essayist was. You know, if you go, as I have, through the collected essays, you watch a man who is taking responsibility for telling us about American literature. He's a man informed enough to tell us that Gertrude Stein praised the prose style of Ulysses S. Grant in her book Foreign America. But better than that, Fitzgerald, Sinclair Lewis, W.D. Howells, Edith Wharton, Mark Twain, you name them. He has given a history of American letters. In addition, where neglect has been shameful, as in the case of Dawn Powell, he came forward in the New York Review of Books to speak of her 15 out-of-print novels, none of which remain out of print now. I wasn't ready. I was part of the Vietnam generation, and I thought that I knew everything I needed to know about the ugliness of that war, but I didn't know. I didn't know about the ugliness of the Civil War. I didn't know about the things that Gore Vidal has been writing about diligently, emotionally, passionately ever since. When I say passionately, this is a man to whom cliché is an enemy. This is a man to whom that kind of Capra-esque sense of what it is to be American is irrelevant. He writes heartlessly about what has happened to America. And in his heartlessness, there is more passion than most of the bleeding hearts could ever provide. That is to say that over the last several years, he has issued three pamphlets. He says, everything comes full circle, and at the end of my life, I am become a pamphleteer. Like the authors of the Federalist Papers, I am writing, says Gore Vidal, a book called Perpetual War for Perpetual Peace, in which he writes both new material and gathers up material on the American Empire. Then came Dreaming War, Blood for Oil, and the Bush-Cheney Junta. I love that this is on the cover of a book. Gore Vidal, An Imperial America, was the third book in the trilogy of pamphlets. His most recent, his second volume of his memoirs, is Point-to-Point Navigation. The first, of course, was Palimpsest. What fascinates me, I was reading, and you know, he says he's a populist. And then I thought, interesting, truly, because these books are populist books, interested in teaching readers about the history of religion, the history of the empire. He has the diction of an aristocrat, but the passion for inducting Americans into the truth of our history of a populist. He wants to be understood. His passion is lucidity, accuracy, and truth. Behind this curtain lurks Gore Vidal, and I will join him in just a moment.
I was brought up in Washington, D.C. in the 40s, and we had a very great president then called Franklin Delano Roosevelt, who traveled around in one of these wonderful carriages. And in due course, a lot of funny stories came out of the president on what it was like being wheeled around all the time. And he said one day, he was not very mechanical, he was trying to work out, they have an intricate break on this thing, and if you're not careful, you're apt to end up on the floor. So the president was trying to work this out, so he yells to Missy Lehand, who was his secretary, and just said, get me somebody from the Navy Department. So they get a young sailor over who was terrified of meeting the emperor, and Roosevelt is sitting there fiddling with the brakes and everything. And he said, well, it's a good idea if you would lead me into the next room. You know, push like that, yes. The boy is hysterical. So the boy starts to push the president's chair. And then it's the red shoes. The boy can't stop pushing. And the president is hanging on for dear life to the sides of his chair. And finally, the boy doesn't know what to do, and he sees an open door up ahead. So he heads for that, thinking there might be something to stop this terrible progress. And there they are, in a filing cabinet. And the president, when it was over, and the Secret Service were hysterical, the president said, yes, presidents often think about assassination. I thought my time had come. Then I realized I was simply being filed. So I always think when I come out on stage in this, I'm just being filed, that's all. They will eventually cover me with cellophane. I haven't been here in 70 years in Santa Fe. When I left, I was still a student at the Los Alamos Ranch School at Otaway, up above. I cannot say I enjoyed the experience at all. It was a pure Theodore Roosevelt, the wrong Roosevelt. Roughing it, living outside, sleeping on a porch in February. I think we all had pneumonia. It was pretty awful. But some interesting people were there. Just before me, there had been William Burroughs, a secret which is everybody in Santa Fe is so, you know, told at birth never to acknowledge. But he was indeed there. And a great friend of mine, Wilson Hurley, whose father was a friend of my grandfather, Senator Gore, of nearby Oklahoma. And Wilson, I gather, has become a very distinguished painter, so something for our team. But it was a strange, surreal, is what one thinks about the desert, if you're new to it, as I was. So I loved the desert, hated the school. Anyway, delighted to be back. And now you've got an interesting governor. I'm not going to campaign for him or anything like that. But he's somebody who's interesting. It's very rare, you know. By the time you get to be governor, whatever you had that made you interesting has long since faded away. And now I see you've just been showing a picture by my friend Shirley MacLaine, The Apartment. One of the best movies of that period, in the 50s, wasn't it? 50s, 60s. And over to you, Michael.
Well, that movie, The Apartment, was a movie about corporate hypocrisy, mm-hmm. which makes for a perfect introduction to our conversation.
Good.
I wanted to begin, perhaps the most powerful message of this trilogy is the manner in which we are witnessing the shredding of the Bill of Rights, perhaps the most important document for the freedom of Americans. And I wanted to begin by asking how this has been accomplished.
Well, by deception, by guile, by all sorts of malevolence. It's strange. Aristotle says, he writes quite a bit about republics. He knows a great deal about them. And he said the danger to a republic is this is going to change into an empire, and the people who are running it are going to get ambitious, and they want to conquer other countries. That happened a bit with us. But he's going into the types of revolutions, and he said those that are done through calculation, one class against another class. And then he said, they're those that are done by stealth and by theft. Welcome, Ari. That is what happened to us. And I never thought we would collapse so quickly. There we were with Magna Carta. We had habeas corpus. We had all sorts of things. The English did leave us some nice presents. And certainly due process of law was one of them. Then comes this very ugly sort of gang. They're in it to make money. They're in it to gas and oil folks from Texas and so on. They were out for the big money. If I may share a piece of news with you, which I just happened to hear out of Washington, Dennis Kucinich, who's turning into a very useful politician. Uh, Dennis came up with a piece of news which I had not heard yet, that getting ready for what is to happen after the surge, supreme victory for us. But Dennis said that one of the conditions they are now making, which is why the strange, strange man full of metal, you know, the Tin Man of Oz, the vice president, one of the things he made his second trip, God, he loves our troops, the second trip he has made over there, which we've been following. I mean, he's been telling them what he wants, and advising them on what to do, the Iraqis. One demand that he is about to make, all that Wolf Blitzer could tell us, Wolf is just in there first with the news, but Wolf said he's over there to tell the parliament of Iraq to get its act together and prepare to doing something about its own defense. Then, Wolf said, and also adjust certain of the oil laws. Well, Dennis, 2 days ago, right on the floor of the House, said he's going there to demand, as a condition of our withdrawal, privatizing oil in Iraq, which means there is Mr. Halliburton himself in Iraq getting ready to tell them to turn over all the oil to his companies. Aren't you proud to be an American? How we slipped off the map of the world will be a story that they will tell at midnight for many, many years. I'm basically somewhat optimistic that we are generally a skeptical people and very strong about when it comes to our own rights if we understand them. So I'm not totally pessimistic, but you know, as Benjamin Franklin was leaving the hall where Philadelphia, where the Constitution was being put together, an old lady friend of his said, "Well, Ben, what are you giving us?" And he said, "We're giving you a republic if you can keep it." Well, a couple of young Turks overheard this. They didn't like Franklin at all. He was too cynical for them, but he was also too realistic for them. So they went to him and they said, "Well, you know, Mr. Franklin, this is a very gloomy thing you're saying." Franklin said, "I don't like the Constitution as it's drawn up, but we need good governance quickly. I'm all for accepting it. I don't want any arguments about it. I don't want any amendments to it. Just we'd go with it for the time being." He said, "In due course, we will lose it as other countries, other republics have lost theirs." "Well, why did they lose theirs?" asked the young men. And he said, "Due to the corruption of the people." "No, you guys are okay. I think you're wonderful. You know exactly what you're doing." He said, "All of you are corrupt, and you'll lose it." And that is, he said, is the history of politics throughout the world. So on that cheerful note, let us continue with literature.
Well, I did want to ask for the distinction between a republic and an empire.
Well, republic is res publica, as we know from Latin class, and that is things that have to do with public affairs. Nothing grander than that. But res publica was shorthand that the Romans used for their thing, really, which was the Republic of Rome. And it was governed very tightly with checks and balances, and two consuls each year gave their names to the year. It was pretty well thought out. The founding fathers hated and feared military force. They did not want a standing army. Jefferson finally broke down and having his problems with the Barbary pirates in the Mediterranean, he had to end up with building a fleet just so our ships would be safe. To a man, they were against it, because if you have a standing army, you're going to lose it. I can remember a lot of it. My grandfather, Senator Gore, who was one of the founders of the Populist Party, organized, his father organized Mississippi and half the South as populace, which meant you didn't go into foreign wars, you did not do wars of aggression against your neighbors, with which they also had the blessing of the greatest Republican of all, Abraham Lincoln, who fought in the Indian Wars and then later highly disapproved of the war with Mexico. And then the great voice on that, the great moral voice, was Ulysses S. Grant. Nobody thinks of him as a great moralist, but he was. He was a young first lieutenant, and he was in the battle at Veracruz. And he was just out of West Point. And years later, when he came to write his memoirs, he said, "I've always thought that what the United States did to Mexico was the most vicious act that one neighbor can do to its other. That we were behaving like the worst of the European powers, predatory powers." And he said, "I always felt that nations, like individuals, must suffer for their transgressions. And I believe the Civil War was the judgment of God on us for what we did to Mexico." Wisely, the Mexicans are now filling up the state, so.
Many people believe that the Civil War was fought to free the slaves. No. This is an American lie. What is the truth?
Two aspects of the same society with the same constitution, same laws, same generally agreed upon values, but Lincoln got it the first time out. We cannot survive half slave and half free. With a fight every time a new state is coming into the Union. I mean, Maine was coming in, and then Missouri was coming in, and Maine didn't want to have slavery, and Missouri did. And the Missouri Compromise was a mess, but it kept the peace for a time. No, Lincoln, of all people, was not an abolitionist at all. He said, if slavery isn't bad, nothing is bad, but he didn't feel that he had any writ to free them. He was all for the government purchasing the slaves and paying off the slave owners. And then he with Henry Clay, he liked the idea of shipping them out to Liberia or to Central America. And he had a bunch of very brilliant African Americans, preachers, lawyers, so on, from New York City. And he got them down to give them a pep talk. You must lead your people to go to Africa. They said, "What are you talking about? You know, what do we want to go there for? We're born here. We've lived here as long as your family has lived here. No, we're not going. Rethink this." Lincoln reluctantly did. The mythology that we create, though, this is one of the reasons I wrote some 30 books about American history, was I couldn't bear the high school books. I mean, they were telling nobody the truth about anything. But in time, all things will pass.
If we were to imagine that we had at our disposal a way of teaching young people to become informed citizens.
Oh, I've worked it out. Don't worry about that. I know exactly how to do it.
Please tell me.
I'll tell you. And I'll also tell the audience, but don't you tell anybody else what I've told you. I would start when a kid is 6 years old, say, learning how to write, add and subtract. I would immediately teach him history until he's 17, or her. At the age of six, to solve all the religious problems, and oh, how extraordinary they are, every day I shake with awe and wonder at the wars of religion that we now have going on. Well, teach them everything about creation. Give them Big Bang. Kids love Big Bang, you know. I mean, you're home free with that one. And give them the giant turtle that the Chinese fancy. give them anything that you can think of that is pretty colorful, that also will reflect upon the way we live now. Also, you're quietly teaching them about the Orient, you're teaching them about China, about Japan. I mean, we grow up knowing nothing but Protestantism, which is rather disagreeable, if I may put a face on it. And let them know everything. Then, as you keep teaching over the years, puberty comes, you get to the delicate subject of sex with puberty. I don't advise Myra Breckinridge for them at that age, but they'll find it on their own. And that's, I think, how you do it. History is the only thing that makes the human race interesting. And we've had a lot of it. Yet, every year, Purdue used to do a poll of all high school seniors. What's your favorite course in high school? I don't know, lunch or something. What is your least favorite? Oh, American history. We've made it boring. Now, that takes genius. It takes teachers with such passion to wreck our history for our people. I mean, complimenti, as they say in Italy. But this is the only way to do it. I had a grandfather. I had to read to him. He was blind from the age of 10. So I read him history. I read him the Congressional Record. At 14, I was the only teenager who understood bimetallism. Thereby hangs the tale. And it was fascinating. I was addicted. And it's easy to addict children if you just give it to them straight. And they can always tell when you're joshing them or bunking them.
Well, one of the things that I've noticed and have written about myself is that if you teach children to read with Go, Dog, Go, you're not telling them anything they don't know. They do learn to read quickly, but they don't learn why anyone would ever want to read, after all.
And they are very severe about not reading.
Very severe about not reading. And so I think it's important to cultivate the child's sense of not only amazement, but incomprehension, to know that there's a vast world out there that is not known to them.
Well, you know, reading was not much admired at the Los Alamos Ranch School. And, of course, I was already come from years and years of reading to Senator Gore. I kept right on reading over the dead bodies of many of the teachers. And at about that time, Mickey Rooney, my favorite star, was starring in Midsummer Night's Dream, which was made by Reinhardt. It's a beautiful movie. Well, I went around talking about the movies. What, you're going to the movies? You're not reading books? I said, well, yeah, I'm reading Shakespeare now because I saw Midsummer Night's Dream in the MGM version with Mickey Rooney, and I wanted to be Puck. I wanted to fly around the world. And I was discouraged by that, you know. It's not the way to read Shakespeare. And I said, well, what other way is there? You either read him or you don't read him. They were in favor of not reading him. And, they were the great-grandchildren of Theodore Roosevelt, who himself was a very brilliant man. But he wanted rough riders, you know, really rough riders. They rough rode over the culture. But I thought that was... Then my experience was, I was 2 or 3 years at the school up there, and they had the Yale edition of William Shakespeare. I read all the way through it by the time I was freed from the prison and allowed to go home. So it was a great experience, and it wouldn't have happened without going to that movie. So use everything.
Both in Screening History and reprised at the beginning of the new memoir, is the idea that, in fact, although it's said by moralists that movies falsify history and culture, that this is a wonderful place for a person to begin, hence what I consider to be your populism, Could you speak about the way in which movies create an appetite for something further?
Well, they do. Although, I used to say when I was a working politician, that particularly to teachers' groups and parents, I always say, you know, I've never met a boring 6-year-old, and I've never met an interesting 16-year-old. What do you do to them? I don't have to talk after that. The entire audience is telling me what was done and how angry they are. No, it's a ghastly system that we have. And again, it's sight reading, in which you don't really know what you're looking at, and you don't learn how to read properly. But you can turn people on to almost anything if you just make it slightly interesting. No, I thought that... Well, we're so used to doing it badly, you know. And I don't know why. There's a terror, perhaps, that young might learn too much. There's a lot to hide about our history. Great deal to hide, which we do hide. I mean, will we ever see a plausible book about Andrew Jackson? That was a killer. And an enemy of the indigenous Americans and a lot of other Americans, too. So we have to learn candor, first of all. And then, you know, we have an interesting story. Which is unfortunately getting too interesting for me now, but something will happen.
As I was reading the Second American Revolution essay, I was kind of astonished when it comes to candor that we were not going to get any optimistic forecast, that step by step as we, I mean, he takes us through the Federalist Papers. One of the things about Gore Vidal is that what he knows, and he's willing to tell. This is not that kind of writing that appears in places where people read while referring to what experts know and what you don't know. And so we watch in this essay, The Second American Revolution, as the history of how the president became the person to declare war rather than Congress came about. And this is not new with Bush. This has been going on and on in America for more than 30, 40 years. And then we look at the Federalist Papers and we see what the founding fathers had to say about checks and balances. And it wasn't the altruistic thought that we've been taught it was. It was the very careful balancing of a belief in the people with the knowledge that government is by and for the rich. And I wondered where you learned to write without placebo, without...
Well, if you had a grandfather like Senator Gore, he was pretty sharp and hard. And he was incapable of lying, which got him into a lot of trouble. He remained, I think, 30 years senator from Oklahoma, which is the heart of the Bible Belt, and he was an atheist. They never found out. They weren't very curious, and he wasn't curious to tell them. So he just went to his grave, you know. They did build a huge, ghastly-looking tomb for him in Oklahoma City. It's like that monument at Palmyra, you know, it's Greek. But it's mostly Greek, so he would have liked that, you know. No, and not teaching kids what they want. I mean, I can remember, I had 4 or 5 years of Julius Caesar's campaign biography about how he conquered Gaul. Just boring a book as ever written. And it was Montaigne who blew the whistle on it. Montaigne said, you know, we're all interested in Caesar, how he managed to overthrow the Republic. how he was the greatest soldier of his time without much training. We all want to know how he did these things. Instead, he is so vain. All he wants to do is convince us what a great engineer he was. He's always building bridges, roads, on and on. And I can remember irritably asking my Latin teacher at Exeter, and I said, you know, when are we going to get to the Roman Empire? Said, what? Well, I said, yeah. I mean, I had already read further along. I'd already read about Augustus and so on. Well, they said, you're not. We're going to have, I think, the Aeneid. And I said, well, that's okay. It's a poem. And they said, oh, you'll love it. It's a treasury of irregular subjunctives. I didn't love it.
Tell us about Montaigne's essay about lying.
Oh, it's very great. He said that of all sins, the one most deservable of capital punishment was telling lies. Wouldn't be happy now, would he? And he said, you know, once you let the tongue get its get the habit of telling lies, it cannot give it up. And he said, without our common language, that's all we have in relation to one another. He said, perhaps if you can assume that whatever someone says is going to be a lie, you can get the truth out of it by going taking it backwards, you know. Well, whatever he says is bound to be untrue. But he said, it is the most vicious of crimes. And he complained about blaming children for telling lies. He said they simply exaggerate because they have no sense of proportion. And they can soon figure out, you know, if what they're saying is considered reprehensible. He said, they'll learn that. They shouldn't be, you know, pestered with our desires for virtue. But he said, without the truth, we are nothing. And I find that truer and truer and truer and truer. And the ease with which so many people do it now, it's part of being a commercial civilization. But, you know, even that has a degree of dignity to it about, you know, Chinese ought not to say that that awful wheat germ is enriching your bones and it's turning you into bones.
I wanted to move from lies to the lie of literature, which is often encompassed in the word style. In fact, Huckleberry Finn tells us at the beginning that you won't know about him unless you've read a book called Tom Sawyer, written by one Mark Twain. And in that book, he says, Mark Twain told a few stretchers that will now be corrected by Huckleberry Finn himself. And with Huck Finn is born a certain part of the American colloquial style.
Oh, yeah.
Inventing style versus lying. How does the art of fiction find its truth rather than invent lies and nonsense?
Well, it's done with sentences. And some sentences are better than others, you know. My grandfather, when he first came to the Senate, supported the family, my mother and her brother and his wife, on the Chautauqua circuit. He was a great orator. And everybody come from, I pay a fortune to hear Senator Gore. And Mark Twain was also on the circuit, so he got to know Twain very well. Can you imagine you have somebody in front of you whose grandfather knew Mark Twain? Is this a lie? It would be if Truman were here, it would be. But, no, Twain had many long talks. You know. And they were both agreed that there's someone else on the circuit that they hated, whom I've done two movies about. Pat, what's his name? Pat Garrett. He killed Billy the Kid. Wayne said he didn't kill Billy the Kid. It's a blowhard, you know. And so my grandfather accepted that Pat Garrett was a liar all the time. And didn't like him anyway. But suddenly, you know, that put me in the center of American myth. And then my time up on the at Otowi, I did get to know the state pretty well. And I was in and around Billy the Kid country, and I did actually 2 movies about him, I think, maybe 3.
Which ones?
The last one was done by Ted Turner with Val Kilmer. And the first one was Paul Newman, much younger days. And that was called The Left-Handed Gun, which was a royal mess. But.
Loved by the auteurists.
Hmm?
Loved by the auteurists.
Oh, the French loved it, you know, which is always a warning sign.
But lies and truth and fiction, because a good deal of the historical novels that you've done have had answers to historians that are...
Well, they aren't really that much fiction anyway. They are anything I have Lincoln say in a book called Lincoln. He either said, or I have pretty good reason to think that he did say it. I have evidence that he did. And that's how you do it. Then why bring in fiction? You bring in fiction to have other voices. The one thing a historian must not do, and so many of the bad ones do it all the time, is give your opinion. You know, nobody's interested in your opinion as a historian. You're supposed to tell as best you can the story of the historical figure from what remains of his life. That's quite enough. It's hard work, too. Then you let it sort of settle, you let it cook. Then if you're doing a historical novel, what my method is to invent 2 or 3 people who can give my opinions. But I'm not taking any credit for it, no, no. John Hay is suddenly just John Hay, secretary to Mr. Lincoln, and later Secretary of State for Theodore Roosevelt. And he had a pretty terrible time of it. So it just adds music to a text. Otherwise, you're going to write very dry history. It's all right. I like it dry.
In the Golden Age, you come as far as that series is going to come into the present. But I gather that you're working on a book in the History of Empire series that will take in Polk and the Mexican War.
And well, that's the big hole in the work. You know, that I didn't deal with that, and that's our first overt imperialist grab. And if we don't understand that a bit better, we'll never understand why we're in the Middle East. So it's all linked together.
Can you write about why we're in the Middle East by writing about Polk in Mexico?
Sure. I'm not going to tell you how.
But why are we in the Middle East?
Well, you heard about restless leg syndrome that all the ladies are suffering from now? You see that poor woman, you know, twisting away all night long with her restless leg. I love our doctors. They always think of some new disease, you know, with a new medicine to fix it. And she's got some patent medicine that she takes so she doesn't suffer from restless leg syndrome. That's why we're in the Middle East. Just restless leg. Restless leg, yeah. And we really love Jesus, you know. We want to make him happy.
Is there anything that you can see at this point that could be done to make this government sufficiently represent the people so that they would hear that we do not want to be there?
What, the people there or the people here?
The people here. How would we
Well, they're not used to being listened to, you know. They wouldn't believe it.
They wouldn't believe it?
No, they're out of the loop. And nobody pays any attention to them. And the contempt that Bush and Cheney have for the people is just, you know, it's glaring. You'd think they'd have a little shame about having, you know, done such a terrible job. I did a play years ago called Romulus Der Große, was the German title, about the last Roman emperor, Romulus Augustulus. It's a play written by Dürrenmatt in German, Swiss playwright.
Romulus the Great, yes.
And it's an interesting notion. He always had interesting notions. And I thought I could help it out doing a version in English for Broadway. I don't think I helped it very much, but anyway, Romulus is a mystery man. He's the final emperor of Rome. And you don't know until the end that he has made himself emperor so that he can destroy the empire. Because it was immoral. And he, in turn, as the last emperor, I'm sitting now upon a crown of skulls. But look now at this beautiful globe, and he's talking to the Germans who have just taken the city of Rome. He said, I'm ready to be executed. He said, before I go, let me watch. Look at this empire. This great empire that used to move because of the breath from my lips. In its blue seas, dolphins, golden cities, golden grain. It was the wonder of the earth. And then it began to scorch the earth, set fire to the earth. And so I let it go. That was the end. Not a happy tale. Okay, I'll put it back together.
Thank you.
I'm leaving Texas out this time.
No, I don't want to proceed by point navigation. I want to hear... Do you think that this administration is bent on ending the empire?
Instinctively, I think they do. Yeah.
Instinctively.
They're too stupid to have a plan, but they... You don't just by accident send Mr. Bolton to the United Nations, which he hates. You don't send Wolfowitz, who knows nothing about banking other than perhaps larceny, to the World Bank. You don't make all these mistakes unless you must have some kind of plan or some kind of terrible instinctive response to these things. I know the family, sort of family he came from. They were deep Republicans. His grandfather, Prescott Bush, worked for the House of Morgan. They loved money, people, a lot of money people. And they were told that Franklin Roosevelt was the devil and Eleanor Roosevelt was even worse. And I know how those people talk. I was brought up around them. And I can't say I ever admired them. And I never thought we'd ever let one of them, after Franklin Roosevelt and Eleanor, I'd ever allow one of them near the presidency. But it came to pass because everything's bought. Now with television, everything is marketing. If you have all the money to market your product, which is the dreaded Bush family, You can buy the presidency for them. They don't have to do much of anything, except pick the wrong people.
Who bought them the presidency?
It was done pretty much at the time by corporate America. Father Bush was, you know, a perfect. Nixon said something very interesting about his then vice president, George W. Bush, whatever he's called, and. Nixon was talking to an old friend of mine. What's his name? Murray Kempton. Many of you may remember him. A great liberal journalist who worked for the New York Post when it was still a good newspaper. And Murray became friends with Nixon after Nixon fell. It often happens. Journalists who hate a public figure, the public figure hates the journalist, and they finally, in the end, they're the only two who can stand each other. So the two old boys would have lunch from time to time, and Nixon would tell him just wonderful stories out of school and what he really thought about people. And Bush was running for president, and it looked like he was perhaps going to be elected. So Murray said to Nixon, who was living in New Jersey then, "Let's have lunch. I'm very interested in your former vice president," and so on. So they have lunch. And Nixon was a great snob. And I don't mean in a social sense. He was an intellectual snob. He himself was very intelligent. Mr. Bush wasn't, and didn't. You don't have to be, you know, a savant to figure that one out. So Murray said, "Well, what are we to expect? It looks like he might be elected." "Well," Nixon said, "don't expect too much. I mean, he's a lightweight. He's the sort of person," and he shook the jowls, "sort of person you appoint to things, you know, like the UN. And, or vice president, you just appoint him to things. Nothing there, really nothing there. Now, she is really vindictive." That was the highest adjective in his lexicon. Nice to know we had such a wise man amongst us, and so troubled one.
I want, though, to know, is there no longer in the corporate structure someone who sees how horrible this has become? I mean, how do we manage to have so many conglomerates without human vision?
Or they don't declare dividends either. It's capitalism for you and me and two or three others. That's about it. No, they're not serving a public or the republic, which is a pity, but that's bad education and a mentality of grab, grab, grab. I mean, to see Cheney wandering around Baghdad getting ready to steal all their oil for Halliburton, I mean, that's his, you know, that's the pits. And, you don't get there overnight, I'll tell you that. You have to be in training for it.
It leads me to the question that I most like to talk to you about. You say in the essay about Don Powell that the same, perhaps, thing that happened to the dinosaurs, that a comet came along and extinguished the dinosaurs, and that something similar happened to literature, that a comet of some metaphysical kind came along and there was no more regard for literature. But how did that happen?
Well, every society plays the games it wants to play. We got television, and then we had the movies before that. A lot of very pretentious people who had formerly been literary decided that this was the ninth muse. And nobody, all these people who celebrate film and just, you know, think it's the ultimate of all the arts, well, of course it isn't. And it's not for one very good reason, which nobody goes into. It cannot express an idea. It has no brain, the movies. It's wonderful at adventure, at tugging your Betty Davis could always make me cry, but I don't think I learned anything from her. Except not to smoke, you know. And, you know, you play with these things as best you can. If you want to tease somebody, a real cineast who's in love with the art of film, they all particularly admire Battleship Potemkin, which is considered the greatest movie ever made. And it's about the Russian Revolution, as you know, and the battleship which the workers steal. Sailors steal it. And they opt out of the revolution, out of the European war, too. Well, it has a famous scene in it, which has been, Eisenhower has been copied and copied and copied. There's a baby in a baby carriage on some wet steps on a rainy, cold night in Petersburg. And somebody pushes the baby's carriage, and it goes bump-de-bump-bump-bump-bump-bump down to the bottom of the steps. Oh, this is so superb, superb. Whenever there's a Frenchman around, I want to hit him. They start in, I've never seen, this is the greatest moment in the history of human culture. I say, yeah, what does it mean? Who's the baby? What does it signify? No, we're not in favor of sending babies in baby carriages down steps. But I think we all went to the theater knowing this was not a wise thing to do, you know, in the world of childcare. Well, when you're up against stuff like that, then you find that the French auteurs are just as silly as everybody else on how much they love their art form. I was talking about this on Italian television not long ago. I had a terrible translator. I was doing an English mistake. And I said, it's the ninth muse, I said. My translator said, cinema is the ninth mule. I may adopt that.
But you've spoken of how at the beginning of your career, from 1945 to 1950, it was still possible to be important as a novelist. That a novelist was...
Well, it seemed like it, yeah. I don't think it really was, but it certainly seemed like it. And there was still excitement over some of us who were coming along. And Mailer believed in the great writer syndrome, and I guess I did too. And then we had our predecessors, Hemingway and Fitzgerald, and then we looked into the middle distance, and there is Truman Capote.
Why, once you realize...
He sounds like Gonzalez, doesn't he? Capote. Yeah.
He sounds like...
The Attorney General of the United States. I just hear my voices. Don't worry about it.
No, I'm with you.
Okay.
Once you realized that it was no longer possible to be discussed in the Agora, as you say, you continued your career as a novelist.
No, I think I continued as an essayist, and the greatest of those was Montaigne, who wrote brilliantly. When I realized that I could not govern others, I then turned to govern myself. Not bad.
Can we tell the people about Shriek?
Shriek?
Shriek, the new translator of Montaigne.
Oh, Screech, Screech.
Screech! I'm sorry, I thought it was Shriek.
No. Screech is a beautiful name. He's a don at, Oxford, Cambridge, and has just done a brilliant translation of Rabelais, which nobody else has been able to do, which I haven't read yet, but I'm told it's very good.
I got a copy, but what happened was I'd been reading Montaigne, and then when I was reading Vidal, he quoted from this new translation, and really... These are very important essays if you want to know about a human man talking about what it was to be human, and this translator, Screech.
Well, he had taken over from an older translator who was not so
Frame. But he captures nuances and colloquialisms. In other words, what had been introduced to me as a chestnut of civilization became an active, vibrant, funny, truthful, weird.
Montaigne was mayor of Bordeaux twice, and very political, working for Henri of Navarre, who was king of nearby Navarre. And the Valois were in residence in Paris, and he's trying to supervise things, Montaigne. And he's rather good at it. Anyway, he's very funny. People come to me and say that when I was mayor of Bordeaux for 4 years, nothing ever happened. He said that was my intention. So perhaps he was a closet Coolidge.
Now, in the case of this translator, he has done, it seems to me, a service to civilization by giving us a Montaigne we can read and enjoy and return us to certain basic human truths. Is this still an option available to the writer?
Sure. Particularly the essayist. All you have to do is connect with the reader, and if he's going to read your essay, it's probably he's interested in your subject for some reason, in which case you've already got him partly hooked. Now, what is beautiful about the essay is, even more so than people like Shakespeare, is you hear an authentic voice from 500-600 years ago talking in your ear. And he can't be changed, you can't do anything to him except maybe destroy his work, but that's it. No, I think it's the only form of writing that will last any length of time.
Really? So you don't think your Empire books will become a kind of...
No, you'd have to have people who are interested in novels, who understand what a novel is and what the dynamism of a novel is. And that takes perhaps a little bit more practice than most people get. But, you know, if they started with interesting books in the school, who knows what might happen.
Is it possible to demand that our children be given better educations? I don't have children, but the children be given better educations. How could we enforce our need to have children be better educated?
Well, find out what it was the Russians were doing. They taught them the classics. It's not look at Jane, look at Bob, look at Jane, look at Bob, look at Bob Run, you know. You might get another Gertrude Stein, but you're not going to do much better than that. I think with children you throw them in deep, you know. Just dump them in. Deepest part of the pool. They'll swim.
You've watched America come to a point. You have already called it a national defense state. Mm-hmm. Will it be a police state?
Oh, sure. How could we avoid it? Go through the airports. You can see the beginning of the tyranny. They're very thrilled at what they're doing. And they've only begun. Luckily, we're running out of money. That's what's going to save us. There won't be any money for these wars. No more homeland defense. You know. Defense from what? The real enemies are in offices in Washington.
Will they attack us?
I don't think they are there. Who's they? Why would a Muslim want to attack us? Now, Osama bin Laden has been very clear about why his gang did.
Oh, I'm talking about our army.
Oh, our army. Well, stretch thin, I think, is the expression we use now. Stretch very thin. Why it doesn't move on, I don't know. Because horrible things have been done to it. I was born at West Point in the cadet hospital. And half my family is military. And I don't enjoy this at all, what has been done to the army. But...
because the brilliant nuance of perpetual war for perpetual peace is to see what the government did to Timothy McVeigh as only another version of what they have done in the Middle East.
Oh, yeah.
And the use of the army illegally to attack...
Well, that's what drove him crazy, you know. They were in violation of the Posse Comitatus Act of 1875. They were using American troops against American people. And he found that despicable. I said, I think you were a little extreme in the revenge you took. I said, you killed slightly more people than they did. He agreed. But he said, anger is a great solvent or something like that. He's a very smart guy. He started to write to me, and I wrote him back. And I learned from the exchange.
At lunch today, I asked you how you live, and you said that rage is...
keeps me going.
Keeps you going. Of course, you're, again, in a minority of Americans who have tried to condition themselves against rage, deploring...
Well, that's what's wrong.
Yes, it is. That's what's wrong.
Thanks for telling me.
We've become obedient, and we like to be pleasant. It seems to me that one of the things that we least like now is to ruffle feathers, tell people things they don't want to hear, raise the voice against politeness and decorum. And I know that from through years of activism, you've trained yourself to be rather fearless in the face of people who do not want you to say what you have to say, who've pulled the plug on you when you've been on television.
There was a journalist who did profiles for Look magazine, and she did one on me sometime in the 1960s. And she went to see my father. Journalists never think to do obvious stuff like that, but he was a very shrewd person. West Pointer, aviation man. And she said she went up, he lived in Avon, Connecticut, and she went up to see him. And said, where does Gore get this from? You know, he's so courageous. My father said, in what way? She said, well, you know, he's taken on Nixon, he's taken on the Kennedys, he's taken on this, taken on that. My father said, well, what's brave about it if you don't care what people think of you? That was a good father to have.
I want to thank you for having provided an admirable example of good fatherhood. Thank you.
You've been listening to a Lannan podcast. You can subscribe to our podcasts at podcast.lannan.org. In addition, the Lannan Audio Archives present similar programs by national and international writers, poets, and social activists at www.lannan.org. Listen to hundreds of hours of recorded programs from the likes of Seamus Haney, Joy Harjo, Eduardo Galeano, Arundhati Roy, Jim Harrison, Edwidge Danticat, and Noam Chomsky. New programs are added every month to both the podcasts and the audio archives.